Welcome in, everybody, to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a very interesting, very good show lined up for you today. You know, we sit around and we think to ourselves after we've lost a loved one, man, I wish I could hold on to him for just one more minute, or man, I wish that this time would never leave, that I could sit around, I could talk to him forever. You want to hold on to him. You want to be able to have that conversation. Even over a decade after I've lost my stepdad, I want more time. And that's not really possible. Unfortunately, we can't have those messages all the time. In fact, it's healthy to let go and healthy to move forward. Today's topic is about those messages from beyond, about receiving those messages from beyond and that initial contact. Our guest today is Von Brashler. And Von Brashler is the author of several books, including Time Shifts, Manifesting, and Mysterious Messages from Beyond. He's a former award-winning journalist and a former faculty member of the Omega Institute for Holistic Studies in New York. He's led workshops throughout the U.S. and the U.K., and he's a lifetime member of the International Theosophical Society of Adyar, India. I don't know why I trip over the word theosophical, Von, but I do. Von recently moved from the Midwest to a cabin in the woods on a rustic little island in the San Juans off the Washington state coast. And you picked the right time to move away from Minnesota, if that's where you were here, Von. I know you wouldn't have liked today's weather, that's for sure. He joins us from Anacortes, Washington. Welcome to the program. Welcome again to the program, Von Brashler. Welcome, my friend. How are you?
Thank you, Tim. It's so good to be back on Darkness Radio.
Yeah, today's weather, the last couple of days, 50, 60, today, snow. So I think you picked a good time to pick up and get the heck out of here.
And I just started my garden. Think of that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's encouraging. We're not looking at gardens anytime soon. In fact, there's an interesting chapter in your book that has to do with pets, and I can only describe them as pets, although they're wild. We have a couple of chipmunks in our yard that we feed on a regular basis, and they're almost trained.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and they're sleeping right now, and we were kind of hoping we'd have the snow gone by now so that we could have them about, because we kind of miss them.
I love the chipmunks. My neighbor's cat keeps the chipmunk population down.
Oh, no.
I've talked to him about it, but he says that's a trophy mouse, my friend.
Well, it kind of is. They're not as big as squirrels, and they're just the cutest little things. And they actually, they're good food for bigger birds, too. Crows and eagles and stuff like that. So, but they love our drain pipes because they're good cover. And we actually have a little birdhouse for them for temporary cover when they're running around the yard, but I digress. So those are our little pets. So we keep them, quite well stocked in seeds. They love almonds, by the way. They're big on almonds.
I only give them peanuts. I'm a chintzy guy.
Well, almonds are their treat. That's kind of like that's the crack of the chipmunk world, just so you know.
Ooh, okay.
I know. I'm giving you useless details here, but
No.
That's the crack of the chipmunk world is almonds. So Minnesota, not so climate-y today. So I'm glad you're in Washington where you can actually get some decent weather. The book is called Mysterious Messages from Beyond. It's out there off the Red Feather imprint from Schiffer Publishing, I believe, correct?
Right.
And fascinating book. I got a chance to have it in my hands here for quite a few days and really sit down with this book and get to know it, which was my pleasure indeed. Messages from Beyond have always intrigued me in a lot of ways. As a kid who I used to be able to, at a very young age, 8-9 years old, be able to tell you who was on the phone when the phone would ring.
Wow.
I find it intriguing that people have gotten calls from the dead. It's something that I wish that I guess I could experience. And
I wish it would stop personally, but well, I hear you.
But and that's kind of what I want to one of the first things I want to jump into is the idea of, you know, in this book you go through the basics of setting yourself up in a way, but to receive those calls.
Yeah.
Not to reach out and get them. And I think there's a difference, and that's what we're going to tackle in this program.
Indeed.
The difference between the two. I think a lot of people who are hobbyists, not paranormal investigators, there's a difference between that too.
Yep.
But there's a strong difference between the two. And I think a lot of people are seeking that answer and are too aggressive when it comes to that, as opposed to laying back, as you point out in this book, and letting it happen. Now, explain to our audience why they should let it happen and not necessarily seek it out.
Sure. Well, I guess this is the result of being a theosophist and a student of Helena Blavatsky. It's a result of being a yoga practitioner. I think that we should let the dead move on. Now, I think that it's entirely proper, however, when the dead choose to contact us, that we listen, you know, but not to encourage them to continue an ongoing relationship. In most cases, if people out there will think back to their own memories and people they've talked to about such subjects, the recently departed will reach out to loved ones, usually within about 3 days, let's say, but around 3 days of their passing, which is probably why a lot of people from different spiritual traditions encourage waiting 3 days to totally bury the body, let's say,
mm-hmm.
embalm the body, you know, incinerate the body, whatever you want to say it, you know, it's, there seems to be kind of like a goodbye period, you know, and I've certainly experienced that. My dad came back to me, and now he wasn't standing in front of me, but it was very clear in a daydream that he was standing in the doorway, and he said, "Hi, son." He said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine, but you're dead." He said, "Ha, we tricked you. That was your mother who died." And I thought for a minute. He said, "Ha, ha, gotcha." He said, "So long, so long, kid."
Aww.
It was great. It was great.
So a joke even in the afterlife, just to kind of throw it off.
Yeah, it was cute.
Well, it's nice that they come around at that time, and I've had that happen. I've had that happen a couple of times where I've had the dream visitation, just kind of the goodbye, the you know, everything's okay here, kid, and it seems like one of them was needed to help me in a time of need. The other was needed for that person in their time of need, which is reflected in this book. And I'm glad it is, because there's stories of both.
Yeah. Well, you bring out the dream, and I'm a very big advocate in actually working your dreams, mining your dreams, utilizing them, and actually advocating setting up programming your own lucid dreams, because in our dreams, our consciousness is wide awake. You know, your brain is sleeping, your body's sleeping, and we tend to roam and explore and investigate and listen in our dreams. So we're like on one level, a higher level of super conscious awareness, wide awake in our dreams. And that's when a lot of people will have insights and they'll have communications. And these are totally legitimate.
Now, there's a difference, though, between actual sleep and dream and setting ourselves up for communication, like you point out in the book. When you're encouraging communication, I say encouraging communication, not reaching out for communication. There's going to be a difference in my words here throughout the program. Mm-hmm. And I think I just need to clarify for our listeners that this is exactly what I'm doing. Is I'm clarifying, I'm using words carefully throughout this. And we'll explain why as we go along. there's steps here to this, and that in which you need to be completely ready or completely setting up the circuit to reach over to the other side and receive this message. Now, there's obviously got to be a sender, a receiver, a medium, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And tell me what else is in this chain that has to happen.
Well, there's four things. There's the sender, the receiver, the message, and the medium.
Okay.
How it's sent. So, you know, when you're sending a conscious thought form, we're talking about thought form projection here. Mm-hmm. Because these are people who are not physically here. You're not hearing with your ears. You're hearing with new ears. So what we're talking about is some people call this telepathy, but this goes beyond telepathy. This is conscious thought form projection. This is intelligent communication. This is intelligent energy that's projected. So when you're actually focused in this sense, you're aware of where you want the message to go. And as a receiver in receiving this sort of communication, you have to really be keenly dedicated as a receiver. And it's important to learn to listen. My first teacher was the psychic author Lewis Gittner. And he told me three things you need to learn, Vaughn. He said, you want to write them down? I said, no, Lois, just give it to me and I'll listen. He said, well, there's the key. He said, the first thing is listen. I said, what's the second thing? He said, listen. He said, do you want to guess what the third thing is? I said, listen. He said, you got it. He said, listen, listen, listen. He said, if you listen, there's a lot you can hear, but you have to be ready to listen. Now, this is listening not with your physical ears. It's not even seeing with your physical eyes. This is something new, hearing with new ears, seeing with new eyes. So what we need to do is tune in to our inner self, our spirit, our soul, our inner light, you know, our essential life energy, our inner consciousness, and when our inner consciousness is attuned out there and is activated and aware, then we're keenly aware of what's going on. We're truly listening. So this is listening in a different sense. This is not anything you can record necessarily on a recorder. This is not a physical sound. So a lot of people say, oh, I just heard it inside my head. Exactly. You heard it inside your head. So, you know, you need to learn to actually listen and be dedicated to listening.
There's a whole bunch of questions that come up when you bring that up. Mm-hmm. The first one that comes to mind is, how do I trust that voice in my head? How do I know it's real?
I asked Lewis that very question.
Okay.
So he said, you know, he said, you'll know. He says, the little hairs on the back of your head are going to tingle. He said, you're going to know, and because it's going to tell you things that are true, tell you things that are personal. There'll be a real connection. He said, and there will be nothing frightening or nothing artificial or nothing confusing about it, you know. This is the indication. So I would hasten to add that Lewis, like Madame Blavatsky, always cautioned against mediumship. And I would caution the same thing. You know, don't seek out the dead. Don't try to invoke spirits. But if they reach out to you, listen. You don't know who's calling to you. It could be somebody from afar who needs your help. Could be somebody lost. Could be someone calling for your attention, living or dead. It could be somebody, you know, actually in the future. I mean, in terms of our intelligent energy, our consciousness, when we really activate it, you know, it becomes attuned to the greater consciousness. And in that sense, it's been called higher consciousness. And there is literally nowhere your consciousness as intelligent energy can go. It travels at the speed of light. Therefore, it can go backward or forward in time. There's literally nowhere it can go. It can't go.
For some people, in the way we achieve this as meditation. For some people, meditation is incredibly difficult. I'll just tell you this, Vaughn, and I'll share with our audiences. I was reading the book, and I spent quite a bit of time with the book. I decided to try because I've had a hard time meditating myself. I've had people tell me to try it in different ways. Mm-hmm. I decided to try the way in the book because I wanted to see if I could do it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and by all means, I mean, you got to try it in order to talk about it, right?
Exactly.
So I did. I tried it. And I tried some of the communication methods in the book, too. There are in the book, and I should explain for our listeners, there are different ways, and we'll talk about it in depth a little bit here, communication methods in order for you to try to communicate with other people telepathically. I didn't use another test subject in another room like you do in the book. I tried to send a blind message to someone to see if they could receive it.
Excellent.
Okay, just into the ether.
Yep.
Okay. I don't know whether that's happened yet or not. I haven't gotten a response. But if I do, I do. If I don't, I don't. That person will know. And I'll know. But as far as the meditation goes, here's what I run into. And this is between you, me, and a whole bunch of people listening right now.
Oh, I know. I've gone through meditation techniques that don't work, too.
No. I'm not saying it didn't work. But here's the block I run into. Mm-hmm. I can get myself. What's funny is, okay, I'm a pretty brittle diabetic. So between you, me, and the fence post and everybody listening, you say to relax your, you start at your feet, relax, relax them until you almost get a numb sensation.
Yeah.
Well, I'm numb all the way up into my kneecaps, my friend. I'm already there. But it's the relaxing. I get that. You have to get to the point where you're relaxed. And I did that. So, but it's getting everything to relax. And I think that's the tough part of meditation for a lot of people, especially when you're wound up and you've got 57,000 things going in your day. That's the main part of meditation to get there. So I did get there. Mm-hmm. But here's my thing, and maybe you can explain this to me. You get to a point where you relax, and it's like the mind starts zipping around to different points.
Right.
When you're trying to focus on what it is you're going to, your mind is taking you elsewhere.
Exactly. So I would say to that, when you put yourself to sleep in this way, put yourself to rest, I always say, let the body become heavy, let it become dense, let it go to sleep. You're trying to reach an inner holistic body, mind, spirit harmony so that, your physical side feels comfortable with what you're going to do, because there is a sense of the physical self to want to guard you against releasing control of you. So when you get to the top of your neck, don't forget to tune out the brain. Tell it to sleep and assure it that in the short time that it will be at a sense of rest, that it will be relaxed and everything will be safe. And then, I always say that try to meditate in a very safe, secluded, peaceful, guarded situation. So the body will feel at rest, the mind will feel at rest. So then, I know my Buddhist friends won't like this, but I'm going to say something about mindfulness. We're talking about a deeper meditation here. We're not talking about just feeling good and putting your head down on the desk and feeling the warmth all about you and the connectedness that you have holistically. We want to reach a point where we leave the body, which is alien to Buddhist thinking.
Okay.
You actually leave the body, and your consciousness leads the way. And when I say it leads the way, you're taking your subtle energy bodies, your emotional body, your mental body, your causal body, your buddhic body, so forth, your atmic body, and you leave. And every one of these subtle energy bodies you possess can leave your physical body, can separate from it, because they are non-physical energy aspects of you. And everyone is energized by this same intelligent energy that we call consciousness, or some people call chakras.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Same thing. So when we talk about consciousness, or we talk about energy, when we talk about the seven rays, when we talk about the essential life force, we talk about our spirit, we talk about our consciousness, we talk about our subtle energy bodies, we talk about our chakras, we're talking about the same ultimate reality, which is universal consciousness. You know, I don't want to leave any confusion here, you know, masking this in a series of words.
Right.
This can be very simple, but when we reach this level of consciousness, it is like reaching behind your television and pulling the cord so that no energy goes to your television or your computer or your stereo or whatever you want. And it is now not being artificially fed by this pocket calculator we tend to call our brain or our mind. It is now in surrendering our conscious awareness, our attention, to a supercomputer that dwells within us, our true self or higher self, the spirit that dwells within us, our own higher consciousness. And then when you reach that blackness within you, out of that blackness will come the light. You know, it will come the energy. So I always tell people, leave the spinning dials and in the beautiful sound inducements. Leave all these artificial techniques behind in meditation. You know, the humming, the mantras, you know, all of this, the visual and audio inducements. These things will help you relax, but at some point you need to suspend them, because you can no longer, if you're going to reach this level of inner consciousness, you can no longer be processing words and thoughts and impressions. You can no longer be hearing and seeing and smelling and touching.
So here's what you just said, something that's a little disturbing to me. Okay, so you get to that blackness. That's where I got to, that blackness, and then I passed out.
Yeah, what you need to do is go beyond the blackness, because the blackness is you trying to refocus internally into what is there. And I always advise people to begin to focus then on a clear blank slate. It might help to think of a whiteboard in front of you, in front of your mind's eye. And on that slate, you can see things. You can see what you want to discover. You know, if you're actually sending conscious thought forms, then you actually begin to write on that blackboard what you want to see, where you want to go, when you want to go, and how what outcome you want. You know, this is simply manifesting our reality. But if you're listening, you want to reach this point too, and have a clear blank slate for something to appear. See? So I think that when we look into the blackness and there's no thought and no impressions and no sensory awareness, perception going on, then at that deep level of meditation, then we look into the blackness. And in that blackness, we find our consciousness, our true self, our real self, our inner self. And that is what listens.
Hmm. Interesting. I find too that there's times where even when I'm in deep meditative thought or prayer that I'll blank out too, and I'll just pass out, which is kind of weird. I don't know if I'm trying too hard or what the deal is, but I don't know. I don't know. It's
so back to the blank slate. If you're trying to listen and mm-hmm. receive information, then you picture the slate in front of your mind's eye, mm-hmm. and you patiently wait for not only to hear something inside your head,
okay,
you know, but you actually wait to see an impression of what's on the board, because you know you're also seeing with new eyes. So you begin to, like, this is how people will see things. They'll say, I saw it, but not with my eyes. I saw it in my head. And they say, oh, that was your imagination. But here, if you truly put your brain to sleep, this pocket calculator we carry around with us, our brain, is no longer processing memories. It is no longer fabricating based on what it knows from its previous frame of reference. It is now processing totally new outside information.
So it's at that point where you start to see the slate that you can start to send the message, so to speak.
Or receive the message.
Or receive the message.
Yeah, but we have to be in a receiving mode for it. You know, it helps to, like, if someone is trying to send you a message, you know, you don't necessarily have to go into this deep meditation, but you have to get very still. Mm-hmm. And you have to, like, tune out off your brain and go within yourself. You say, go within and listen. You have to listen with new ears and see with new eyes.
What if you're still caught up in the same old stuff? I mean,
well, you know, you have to put that stuff to the side. This is a world of this is the shadow world. This is a world of illusion. This is a world of abstract things that compete for our attention. A lot of shiny objects in front of you.
Yeah.
And are any of them all that important?
Doesn't seem like it. No. Pardon me, I had to cough there. I get what you're saying there. So when we get to that point where we're starting, or we're there, the question remains, the voices that then come forward, I get that you say that the hair should start to kind of raise on the back of the neck and you should start to get a feeling. How do we discern what's a good feeling from a bad feeling, and what should be trusted and what shouldn't be trusted?
You just have to be able to trust your inner self. You know, first of all, since you've kind of put your brain to rest, you're no longer going to be processing, we tend to, like, process information and evaluate information. Yeah, analyze is the word. So our physical brain is analytical. It's always analyzing things. It weighs information. It measures information. These are very human physical terms. These are things that can't be necessarily weighed and measured in the same way, because they're not physical. These are the things that are beyond the physical. You know, these are the big questions from the spirit realm that are really, really important, you know. And sometimes we have to, like, stop processing silly old memories inside us and really learn to listen to what's out there, the cosmic intelligence out there.
I know with you, you were starting to hear music even before you began to meditate. It was almost like you were hearing, a lot of musicians say they hear music similar, like they just hear it and then they play it. But to you, it was almost like you were, the way you describe it, it was almost like you were hearing the music of heaven.
It was. And the first time I heard it, though, it was like a top 40 station. So, you know, it was kind of funny. I thought, gosh, I said, do I have a filling in my mouth somewhere on one of my teeth that's actually, you know, allowing me to bring in radio waves, you know? And I actually researched that. You know, it's incredible, but I sat there and I listened to this music. And what it was trying to do is get my attention. because there was something I needed to see. You know, a year previously, I had been out at a berry field, and I got a very sharp abdominal pain. And a voice inside me said, you know, walk on the railroad tracks at the edge of the berry field, and you'll be instantly home. You know, and I was so sick, I didn't bother to analyze the silliness of this. How could I, you know, first of all, does the railroad really go to my house? Two, does this railroad track connect anywhere to that town, which was 20 miles away? Three, how do I quickly get there? You know, so, but I walked up there and I told my friends, I'm going to walk on the railroad and it'll take me right to my house. And as I rounded the bend, it all went blank. And then suddenly I was in front of my house. And I remember stepping off the high railroad tracks, walking to my front door, and then telling my mother how sick I was, and then barely making it to the hospital in time for an emergency appendectomy, because my appendix had burst and I did need to get home instantly. And I minimized how I got home. I didn't really explain it because nobody believed me. Nobody believed that this could have happened. My friends insist that, oh, no, this couldn't have happened. I never told my mother the whole story. But then a year later, I'm out there and I hear this music. And I'm trying to think where the music is coming from. And I look to the front of the house and I realize I'm forced to recognize the truth that the railroad track did not stop in front of my house. There was no railroad in front of my house, ever.
Creepy.
So you know, years later, I thought, well, that was really weird. And I'm living on Mount Hood in Oregon. I'm working for the newspaper. And I'm walking along in the woods, along the river, the Salmon River, up in Brightwood, Oregon. And I'm all alone in the woods. I was one of the first houses built along the river after the big flood. And I hear this, like, beautiful music, this angelic music. It's incredible. It's the sound of a flute or maybe a lute, you know. It's incredible. And I try to think what it was, you know. I kept saying it sounds like panpipes in the forest, you know. And I found that couldn't get any closer to the music or further away from the music. However, if I would really hone in my conscious awareness and tune everything else out, I could bring in the music more clearly and with more volume. Mm-hmm. And if I let my consciousness wane and started to look around at the trees and the birds, suddenly the music would diminish and it would become more faint. So clarity and definition is something so important in spirit communication. But yes, I mean, that was another example of hearing music. And I've talked to other people since the release of this book who've had similar experiences of hearing music out of nowhere.
Now, in that neighborhood in Mount Hood, you say you almost saw an image like Pan the flute player, like the actual Pan.
No, I didn't actually see anything. I wasn't able to ever discern what the source of it was.
Okay. I thought I had read something like you thought you felt the energy or something like Pan playing.
Yeah, it did seem to me like what I'd heard of as Pan pipes, you know. I mean, later on I heard music that was close. It was music recorded in the Great Pyramids.
Okay.
By a great flautist. I'm trying to think of his name, but it was very beautiful. And I'm thinking it sounded somewhat like the melody I heard, melody line. And he was just playing extemporaneously within, as recorded in the Great Pyramid. And I'm thinking, like, he probably heard the music too at one time. Because these things are not necessarily, they're projected to you personally, but sometimes they're broadcast by some greater spirits, and they're broadcast rather broadly to a number of people. And let me give you an example of that. Lewis Gittner had an immense garden, and he would go into these deep trances on his back, and they pull down all the curtains, and yet light would fall upon his chest as he was in this deep sleep on his back, somewhat like the Edgar Casey sleeping prophet mode.
Okay.
And so he would come out of it, and he couldn't remember exactly what was said. He would mutter something, and he always explained to me that these were energy spirits would gather and send information to him. And then one day I was visiting him at his inn, and Lewis said, "You know, I got to thinking, I read this book about Findhorn by Dorothy McLean, and I started to think about the kind of messages I was getting and the kind of messages she reported in her book for the Findhorn Garden. Because," he said, "I received very similar information about how to plant." And it is true, you know, his gardens were beautiful. And so he said, "I actually went on a plane. I visited her. I knocked on her trailer there in Scotland. She answered the door, and they introduced themselves. And he said, 'I have to ask you, do you keep a diary?' She said, 'Yes, I do.' So they compared diaries, and they were getting the same transmissions, but like, I don't know, about 10 hours apart. And so Lewis said, "Well, we're not getting them at the same time." And Dorothy said, "Lewis, I think you're forgetting time zone differences. We're getting them at exactly the same time."
Wow. Wow. That's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Vaughn, let's take our break right here. And okay. When we come back, quite a few things I want to talk to you about. I also want to let our audience know a little bit about the difference in the second half of the program as to why we can open ourselves up to a channel and be receptive to messages from the other side, but why we shouldn't go out and seek them. That should be one thing we'll talk about. The other is why you call yourself a reluctant ghost hunter. We'll tackle that in the second
okay.
part of the program. So our guest is Vaughn Brashler. The name of the book is Mysterious Messages from Beyond. It's on the Red Feather imprint on Schiffer Publishing. We'll have a link to the book in the description of this program. You can go ahead and click on it and get a copy of the book right now. I encourage you to do so. It's very informative and some really, really great stories and some inspiring stories in there as well. And some stories in there that will, I think, actually put your mind and heart at ease when you read them as well. So go ahead and click that link during the break. When we come back, more with Vaughn Brashler here on The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Vaughn Brashler. The book is called Mysterious Messages from Beyond. There is a link in the description of our program to click on, so you can pick that up. The book is by Schiffer Publishing and the Red Feather imprint. So we want you to pick up a copy of that today. We've been talking about how to reach out and communicate with the other side, or actually reach out and get communications from the other side. I'm clarifying because as we're talking to Vaughn, there's a difference as to why you want to maybe make yourself available, send out some thought forms, retrieve some of those thought forms. But let's get into this part of the program now, Vaughn, as to why you may not necessarily want to be reaching out to get those communications. Tell us why we shouldn't probably be so eager to go out there and get those communications.
Well, Lewis Gittner always told me, he said, "Be very careful." He said, "If you go out there and wander," he said, "because, yes," he said, "you can go out there, but keep in mind that it's a very busy place." And he compared it to a train station with people coming and going from all time zones and all orientations, and he said that, you know, a train station can be a dangerous place. He said, you don't exactly know what you're getting. It's a place of great confusion. You can easily, he said, get on the wrong train. You can easily find yourself with the wrong companion as you ride in the train. So he said, don't seek it out, but if it comes to you, be ready to listen, you know. And I think that's good advice. I'm very tempted at times to speak to reach out there, and this is possible, you know. I always think of how in the shamanic tradition, if we think of like a Native American or indigenous people who were like shamans for their people, and they would consciously go into these deep trances, which we might call a meditation, and they would leave the body in a consciousness, and they would go into the past and visit with their ancestors, but they would not interact with them. They would simply listen, you know. So many of our spiritual teachers have taught, you know, told us to learn to listen, but they don't necessarily tell us to get involved, you know.
Right.
So you know, you can go, the shaman would go forward in time to look at what lies ahead or what might lie ahead for his people, you know, without interacting, and then come back and report. I always say this is like being a fly on the wall. A fly has 100 eyes, and they're all moving and seeing, you know. So when you leave and you and I do have exercises, you know, to actually go and discover things like lost keys, and you can actually go and you can remotely view. But in good remote viewing, you go out there and you observe. You don't interact, you know. Because you don't want to interfere necessarily with the intelligent energy that's at work there. There's a certain code, you know, if you will. You know, there's a certain karma you don't want to necessarily interfere with. You can actually visit yourself in the past. And if you try sending energy to yourself in the past, you're going to find that the energy is going to bounce back to you in the present. Because, you know, you really can't and really shouldn't get involved there. But there's literally no place and no time you cannot visit in consciousness, because your consciousness is, after all, intelligent energy that travels at the speed of light.
That's an interesting concept. Because, you know, we always think to ourselves, well, if we could travel in time and we could do it through consciousness, there's always been this what if discussion, is if we could do it, could we go back and change things? If we could truly time travel, and you know, you have movies about butterfly effects and things like that. But when you bring up that even if you travel through consciousness, you can't change things, even if you wanted to, it's an interesting tidbit.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, because consider that when you go backward or forward in time and you go to a distant place, even in the here and now, and you're going in a consciousness or energy body, you have no arms, you have no legs, you know, you can't shake hands, you can't, you know, shoot Lincoln's assassin with a gun, you know, you can't sign a contract. You can't dig for gold that you know is there. You lack this kind of this physical traction we have in the here and now. But you have something much more valuable to gain, and that is the knowledge, the foresight, and awareness you bring back with you. This is like impactful on a very personal level.
But Vaughn, as that energy that's come back to observe yourself, could you be that ghost on your shoulder that gives you that weird feeling to get out of the way when you should be getting hit by that car at that particular point or whatever that event is happening at that time? Could you truly interfere in that way?
Well, I think that you're going to bring some awareness with you from the past. I think that all of us tend to, not all of us, but many people seem to have some previous awareness. You know, it's like, if you want to say it's like muscle memory, you know. You have some awareness of the past. Mm-hmm. And of course your consciousness does have some awareness of the past. Your consciousness, unlike your physical mind or body, has an awareness of where you've been and where you're going. You know, it is timeless. It is your inner spirit. It is pure energy. It is your eternal life force that'll continue. It, of course, has some awareness of where you've been, and it has some insight as to where you should be going in this life if we can actually get in touch with our inner self.
Well, then that brings up another good point. Is there a way to, when you're in this state, when you, let's say, reach that inner consciousness, when you're meditating, is there a way to look forward? Do we have a way to look forward or receive messages from a spirit that could say to us, you know what, you do have this in store, rather than just the vague messages we get at times?
Absolutely. Well, with my recent book, Manifesting, it shows how to use thought forms to create or visualize real change in your life. So as a sender of conscious thought forms and projecting our conscious thought forms, you can actually reach out. And you can also do this as a listener. What you do is you go deep within you. You see a blank slate in front of you. You, with your mind's eye, begin to draw or paint a picture of where you want to go, what you want to see, what you want to hear, what you want to learn. And then you actually add the finishing touches of actually doing that. And then you use that as a roadmap to project yourself. I mean, I kind of like lay out steps how to do this. So it doesn't sound as fantastic. When you break it down to 3-4 steps, it actually becomes doable. And you can actually program where you want to go and what you want to see and who you want to observe. And you can actually project yourself. This is remote viewing at its finest. Remote viewing isn't just for the psychically gifted. It's for those who really, we'd say the wise, yeah. The craft of the wise. So it is those who learn to see and those who learn to hear with new eyes and new ears. You know, in researching this, I thought, well, what'll Christians think of this, or people of the Judaic Christian tradition think of this? And I found 37 references in the Old Testament and the New Testament relating to essentially learn to see with new eyes, learn to hear with new ears. All the great teachers have always admonished their students to do this.
That's true. And yeah, reading the book, you have specific passages even of where it says right there to basically open your ears and to listen and to open your eyes as well. And it's astonishing how it all lines up, to be honest with you. I want to ask you why you call yourself the Reluctant Ghost Hunter. What brought this about?
Well, when I was a student of Lewis, I would go and I would never, his association with the students was wonderful. You just go and you just say, is Lewis in? I want to talk with him. And as busy as he was, he would sit down and talk with you as long as you wanted. And boy, did he make good coffee, too. But anyway, Lewis would sit at the table. One day, he sent out one of his assistants. She described herself as Lewis's assistant. Her name was Helen. And I later found out that Lewis was actually available at that time. But for some reason, he wanted me to speak with Helen. Helen described herself as a person who would go in haunted buildings or homes and reach the spirit or the ghost that was there and work with it and communicate with it and help it move on. In other words, she deghosted houses. Mm-hmm. And she worked with me, and she spent the whole day working with me. She said, I don't know. Lewis said, I have to tell you this. She said, what you do with it is up to you. She said, do you want to know more? Do you want to know how to do this? You know? And I said, well, tell me all you have. And I said, I don't really want to do this, Helen. I said, but somewhere down the line, Lewis, it seemed that I need this information. And so she told it to me. And indeed, you know, when I'm living in Oregon, I find people that, you know, report to me that one, the church was haunted, a trailer house in the woods was haunted. There was a cabin. There was a woman whose sister had disappeared. And suddenly I was like working with these, like, you know, kind of ghostly situations. And I found out that some of them are very, very dark, you know. So once again, you don't know who's out there at this busy train station. You really don't. You really don't. You got to be very careful. So you don't just blunder in. You don't just blunder in. I was nearly strangled to death by one. And I would say that was not necessarily a malevolent deceased person, a mm-hmm. ghost. Mm-hmm. I would say that was something else that had confused us and we thought was a ghost. There's, you know, there are real reasons to let sleeping dogs lie. And to ignore and walk around some of these things, there are some dark forces out there. You don't need to seek them out. You know, you need to learn to walk around dangerous situations. I don't know if that answers the question, but I know that there are shows on television and there are celebrities that deghost houses and they're ghost hunters. And I just have a very low tolerance of any of them. Have a very low tolerance of people who want to speak to their dead pets. And, you know, I've done this, I've done it, but you know, you at some point, you know, you want to stop poking the bear. You want to stop going after it. If it comes to you, it wants to say something, listen and learn, you know, but to go out there and mess with these things sometimes is a very frightening situation.
You bring up an interesting point about a healthy amount of grief. I want to tackle that after I ask you this question.
Okay.
And that's this. I hear a lot from psychics and psychic mediums that they're, oh, no, honey, there is no bad thing to the other side. It's all love and light. It's refreshing to hear someone who preaches about light work that there is malevolent stuff out there. So I tip my cap mm-hmm. to you about that. Because I do believe there has to be balance. There can't be good without evil. There can't be black without white. There can't be this and that and the other. There has to be something that balances something. And you've even said you've had some experience with something that's not quite right. However you want to describe it, that's how you've put it. In your experience with everything you've done on a different plane, have you had experiences where you've run into not so nice things on that other side as you've went to meditate?
Well, in meditation, no, it's been okay. I think the ghost hunting is the only really super bad experience I've had. That was truly dark. You know, it involved death and it involved fire. It involved lives changed. It involved a spirit that would not be moved, would not be communicated with, and was very angry when we tried to trick it. You know, it's like Helen's little tricks with the mirrors and the salt and all of that were effective. But there are some dark forces out there. And I don't want to frighten anybody because there's not a lot of it, you know. But you know, you have to be able to walk around it, you know.
You do bring up one of the stories from the book that absolutely chilled me. It was something that Beer City Bruiser and I talked about yesterday on Supernatural News, and that is, and actually it came up a little earlier this week on a podcast I did, and that was the unimaginable scenario, and maybe you can put my mind at ease on this one. You talk about that three-day period when we have other work to do. It came up somehow this week. We were talking about where would you prefer to be buried? And I said, if I were going to be buried anywhere, it'd be in a mausoleum.
Oh.
And I was asked why. And I said, well, because if you ever see what happens to a grave after a decade or, you know, half a century or whatever, after years of, and you know, Vaughn, about Minnesota winters.
Yeah.
There's freezing and thawing and flooding and in the ground, and after, if they ever exhume the body, you look down there and it's nothing but bone soup. Right. So I said, imagine, if you will, my worst nightmare is this. If you've ever seen in certain horror movies someone get buried alive, my worst nightmare is being buried alive. I mean, that to me, the idea that if your soul was at the end, was ever trapped in your body, being one, buried alive, or two, having to watch your body become bone soup inside of a casket, to me, that is nightmare fuel. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I'm going to be trapped in a casket, I'd rather be in a building where, you know, it's nice and people will come by and it's heated and all that other stuff, as opposed to that or being set on fire. I said, being set on fire seems cruel and unusual. And then I read the story in the book about the, and essentially we'll just kind of give it the end of the story, a quick recap, which is that this man who had went and grabbed his mother out of his sister's care and decided to take care of her for himself, and she had dementia. Decided that, and he couldn't take very good care of her, put her in a nursing home. She died in the nursing home. And then he went and lived in one of his apartment buildings that wasn't very well kept, if I remember right.
Correct.
Okay. So he passes away shortly after she passed away in his apartment building. A decision had to be made, and the sister made the decision to have him. It was friends that had made the decision to have him cremated. Because something had to be done with the body. And obviously cremation is the cheapest way of doing it, because, you know, you don't know what he has in his bank account. It may not have been much. But then the phone call that comes into the sister is angry. She's getting very angry phone calls from this gentleman.
He swears at her in words that she hadn't heard since they were children.
And one of the things he starts yelling about is that he's burning.
Ultimately, when the body was cremated, there's a call, and it was on her voicemail. And for a long time, they would play it. Different relatives would listen to it and say, "Oh, yeah, that's your brother." And then mysteriously, it disappeared. And then mysteriously, there was no record of ever having received the call. But there were a lot of people involved. But incidentally, I'll say that the family involved here wasn't really crazy about me reporting this. They were fine with me getting all the information in detail, which I tried to do. But I had to mask all of their names and locations because it's kind of a raw subject. But to the point, when he was cremated, he screamed, "I'm on fire! I'm burning!" and said some terrible things and screamed. And then after that, the call stopped. So I think that, you know, your question, how do you want to end up? I'm going to say I want to be cremated. You know, I think the bones remember, you know. I think it's better to burn us to a cinder. There should be no physical aspect of us yet alive. Because, well, I don't know. I think that every part of your body knows what every other part of your body has experienced. And those bones lying in the ground, sometimes I think they have a memory. I don't know. I think they do. And I think that in his case, when he was cremated, all the communication stopped.
The communication between he and his mother, or he and his sister?
He and his sister.
Okay. So you're saying that, but why would he say he was burning then if the communication stopped?
He was burning because he was cremated.
Right, but you say after the cremation,
the call stopped.
Okay, so but you're saying he was feeling it as that last call was going on, and after he was ash, it was done.
It seemed that as he was being cremated, he had one last call that went out.
Oh.
Which you can imagine haunts the family upon hearing it.
Yeah. That, again, nightmare fuel.
Yeah. But these stories are really not that common, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mostly if we do receive calls from the recently departed, their loved ones who are saying, you know, goodbye. That's what they're saying. It's a way of saying, you know, I'm gone, but, you know, remember me. They're usually very friendly. He's usually not like this. These are unusual situations. You know, when the telephone was first invented.
Well, let me ask one last question. You can continue that thought. So with that gentleman, do you believe then that gentleman is not going to pass on like most other people? Is that gentleman now going to be an earthbound spirit?
I would say no.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, why is that?
There's no sign that anyone has been contacted by him since his cremation. No, and I think a lot of people, you know, they think, well, what makes a person a ghost, you know? And I think when we die and it's kind of a complicated question if you think of it, but when we die, there is a lot of times confusion and reluctance, and there's fear. There's fear to move on. There's reluctance to admit you're physically gone, dead. There's a confusion as to when we die, if you die like in an accident suddenly, you know. So we tend to think of these are the ghostly situations. But I think it's hardwired. I think that your higher subtle energy bodies, your spirit bodies, your higher bodies will automatically leave and ascend and evolve. What's left is your emotional body, your personality memories. These are the imprints that are left with us. And sometimes these remain because not with everybody, but I think with some people, you know, there is a reluctance to move on. There is confusion. There is fear. This is sad. This is why people like my friend Helen would go into homes and try to meet with these people and communicate with them and help them move on. It's just an aspect of you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your whole soul or spirit. It's just an aspect of you that's left behind. It's your emotional body, your personality level imprints. And they're kind of in a sense they're haunted by memories.
Right. And I get that's kind of what you've alluded to, what you believe an earthbound spirit is. It's just that emotional center. But think of the emotions that this guy had before he passed away. I mean, there was real hatred there towards the sister.
Anger. Hatred, resentment, and yes, all of that.
There was loss there too when it came to Mom.
Loss. Yes. And hanging on.
Yeah.
Like the sole survivor, hanging on. It was rather sad. It was a sad situation, you know.
I mean, if that's not a perfect mix to create that emotional center to be hanging around, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
So that's why I asked that question. If you believe that maybe he, part of him at least, might be still sticking around.
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You were saying about the telephone. I'm sorry.
The telephone. A lot of these things, like the brother and sister, will come over the telephone. And this has been happening ever since the phone was first invented. In fact, it happened with telegraph operators in 1913 in London. David Wilson was a telegraph operator who received messages that were, let's say, of an uncertain source. They came out of nowhere, messages from beyond. And then when the phone was invented, you know, I mean, I remember looking up early phone charts. They would publish them in newspaper. You could call John Doe on 3rd and Elm, and it would say that his phone was number 25. He just dialed 25. You know, it's like that's how sophisticated it was. And in the early days of phone, people began getting messages from the recently departed. You know, it's like, oh, we have a way to communicate. Now, if you think about it, you know, our consciousness, our energy, is like electromagnetic energy. So it seems perfectly plausible to me that spirits of any sort would want to use electronic devices. And yes, people have actually seen things on the television. They've seen things on, you know, on computers. I remember getting a message, which was very bizarre, when I worked for the newspaper. And obviously, message from beyond. Telephones in particular, even cell phones, you know, people would get messages. And in the early days of the telephone, they noticed this was incredibly prevalent. And so it's like, wow, it's like a lot of ghosts out there wanted to talk with their relatives. So they actually, you know, people like Bell and Edison, they were actually trying to think about manufacturing a spirit phone to talk to the dead. And people would bring phones, you know, from home, and they bring them to church to speak to the dead. Now, these are phones, mind you, that weren't connected to anything. These were disconnected phones, and yet they were getting messages. There's a long, long history of this.
Yeah, it's amazing how something as simple as RF energy or EMF, it's such a simple energy. It's such a lower frequency energy, but it seems so simple to send communications on, and it pierces a veil so easily. It's amazing at that. I had alluded earlier to when you had mentioned a grief period. You were talking about pets and people and their pets. People bond with their pets quite easily and deeply at that.
Oh yes.
And I've even felt that at times. You talk about in the book feeling a pet, you know, sink into a mattress while you're laying there. But there's a tendency for pet owners especially to want to hold on to that pet long after that normal time. And but the question is, what is a normal time? What is a normal grief time? You know, we say for a human being, you know, there's that 3-day period after they've passed away and then they move on. We remember them from year to year. We remember their birthdays. And it seems like over time, the memories are still there. The grief fades a little, but we still tear up, you know?
Yeah.
But with pets, even though we really do tear up, you know, even 10, 20 years afterwards, or we still have that, oh, you know, that crushing feeling when you think about a pet, because, you know, it was that pet is like a kid, you know, you it's just that bond, and you think to yourself, well, oh, if I could have him by my side one more time right now, I'd do it.
Yeah.
What is that normal grief period? And you do have those people that say, you know what, I would go to a pet psychic tomorrow if I thought I could talk to Sparky.
It's true.
When is it that time to let go?
Well, you know, time is a funny thing. You know, we observe time here only because we have wristwatches, I suppose, or sundials or whatever, you know, but in the greater scheme of things, things happen when they happen. It's a way of measuring change, and things will happen when they change. You know, it's like there is really no, in the greater scheme of things, no such thing as time. It just all runs together. So you think of that song, Mr. Bojangles, after, you know, his dog up and died. After 20 years, he still grieved. You know, this is the way people are about their pets. I used to have a podcast years ago called Healing with Your Pet, Our Psychic Spiritual Connection. And, you know, the people that would call in and with concerns about their pets were people who still grieved over their lost pets. You know, your pets will come back to you, people. They will return to you. You know, I'm confident of that. Or they'll move on. You know, as one of my cats told me from the beyond, I'm fine. They said, but you know, learn to be a better pet owner. That was that was her advice. You know, learn to be a better pet owner. So you know, I think that our pets will naturally come back if they feel a great emotional attachment. I think part of them moves on. Their higher spirit moves on. Their emotional personality might stay behind because they feel a great connection to you, or like ghosts, they'll feel like confusion as to how they die. They will, or their disbelief that they've died, or reluctance, you know, and or they feel guilty, like leaving you behind. So, I mean, I lost a pet when I moved out here from Minnesota a year ago, and this is a dangerous island where I live on. It's in the middle of woods, and I wrote this cat. I could not keep it in the house, and my cat Midnight went outside. And was you know, I thought we'd worked it out, you know, you come go outside and then come back inside, you know, do it very briefly. And I would, for the first several days, I would accompany the cat everywhere outside. And I thought I'd somehow made it aware that it was a dangerous place. But one day it went out, came back, and never came back again. And, you know, I know coyotes got it. It was killed by coyotes. But you know, a year later, that cat is still with me. It appears to me on my computer screen.
Really?
I mean, if you were here, I could show you. And it appears on my screen when I turn it on as though it were my screensaver. But it's not my screensaver. And it was the last picture I ever took of this cat, which is filed away under photos. It is not a screensaver. I have a designated screensaver. And from time to time, it just comes back. And from time to time, I hear it in my room, you know, and for a while, I would feel it jumping on the bed. And finally, I just said, I'm going to acknowledge his presence, but not encourage it to continue. I would say, you know, hello, Midnight. I love you. I miss you, too. That's it. And you know, I tried to reason with this cat, but there's no reasoning to an emotional body. You can't reason with a ghost. You know, it will eventually move on. It'll eventually move on. I don't think it'll stay with me forever, you know.
Yep.
But you have to be willing to listen.
Yep. There's the most interesting analogy I've seen to, or example I've seen to, a residual haunting happened at your old newspaper.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's funny. I worked in radio stations for a long, long time. And I can almost see that happening at a radio station too. And the minute I read it, I understood why. But you, you know, you talk about places of high traffic or high hustle and bustle and people who love their jobs and throw themselves into their jobs. You can understand why there would be a residual haunting of what there is. But tell me why it might have surprised you when you saw what you saw, and tell people what you saw in the newspaper.
Okay, so I was one of these people who had a key for the building, and I would go and work late at night. I mean, I was really focused, and I guess maybe this is why the ghost at the newspaper identified with me, because he was very focused on working too. Long after his physical life was over, he was still there working away. And I noticed that I would go and I'd lock the door behind me, and I knew I was the only person in the building. You know, there was only a light where I was working. The rest of the plant, the newspaper plant, was dark, silent, and unoccupied, or so I thought. And I would hear the big doors, the heavy doors that led from the composing room to the press room, open and close. Now, I'm not the world's strongest guy, but when I opened those doors, I had to use both hands and pull hard. It was not easy to open those doors. They were big, heavy doors.
Yeah.
And but they would just open and close, boom, boom. And I knew what they were because it had a definite sound. It was not a typical door. And then I just kind of ignored it. And then as the evening wore on and I continued to work, I was working in the break room because that's where the snack machine and the coffee machine were, of course. And so I'm working there. And I hear then another part of the building, the front end, you know, where people would come and from off the street and they would go to the counter. And that's where the ladies would be working. Now, at that time, okay, this is a few years back, and we were computerized, but there were some of these older ladies up front that still like to have their old Remingtons up there, right? Mm-hmm. And you could hear, I could hear this click, 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 distinctly the sound of a typewriter. And then you hear that grip when it comes back, right?
Yep.
Carriage return. And then click, 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 click. And it occurred to me years later, why didn't I go and check what was actually printed? Now, there might not have been paper, but, you know, it should have made an impression, the key striking the spindle. Mm-hmm. Rubber spindle. So, but I knew there was somebody there. You know, there was somebody there, you know. And in my mind's eye, you know, I tried to get very, you know, deep and concentrate and meditate and try to listen. And I saw a man with a hunched over old man with one of these like dark green visors like accountants wear. And I'm thinking like he was a compositor who worked at the newspaper. I don't know, but it seemed like somebody was working the night shift forever.
That was no surprise. I read that and to me it didn't seem surprising. To me it just seemed dedicated, and that to me it seems like having I guess having worked in media most of my life, I understand the dedication. I think I'll still be sitting behind a microphone when I pass away. To be honest with you,
could be.
I'll still be editing files. I think that's just the way things will go. Yeah. I think I want to wrap up today, if we can, Vaughn, by telling kind of a beautiful story that has to do with a tenant and a friend of yours who, when she moved in, she was battling cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
I started getting telephone calls when I worked at the Theosophical headquarters in Wheaton, Illinois. And I had been there a short while, taking over from a man who'd kind of started the book program and done it for many years. And so I was sitting in what used to be his desk, you know, and on the desk then was an old, you know, landline phone. And that was used to be his phone. It used to be his extension number. And I hadn't been there too many months, and the phone started to ring, and I would get these series of calls from what sounded like an elderly man in India. Although I would say that an old landline back then, a long distance call to India, the calls were crystal clear. Amazing, as though he were in the next room, you know, and which was unusual for a landline, a long distance call like that at that time. And he would talk to me, but he would not respond to anything I said. And it was odd, but he would say like, I want to invite you, sir, to on a lightning tour of India. And he kept asking me this, to want a lightning tour of India. He said, I do this in the late fall, and I take people, and it changes their life forever. And I want to invite you, sir. And I would say, I think you're trying to reach my predecessor. You know, he said, no, I am calling you, sir. And I went to the other building, where actually sometimes we would get calls, and then they would route them right to the extension numbers. And I asked the lady, I said, did you get calls, these series of calls from what sounded like an elderly man with a thick East Indian accent? I said, no, those must have come to you directly. And I said, I don't know how he could know my extension number. And I'm thinking, well, he was trying to reach my predecessor. And so then the last call was, if you will not come with me on a lightning tour of India, sir, I would advise you to meditate in the early morning light. And I understand this very clearly now. The early morning light is pure, you know, pure light, pure energy, pure consciousness. Meditate in pure consciousness. And so I started doing this, and it was profound. He said, this, sir, will also change your life forever. And I remember going down to the bookstore, and I said, do you have any books on like meditation I said the real stuff, you know, I said the real stuff, mm-hmm. like from Indian gurus, Indian experts, Indian yogis. She said, well, they're all back there in the corner. And I go there, and one is face out, and I grab that one. It was on a bookstand. And I flip it over, and I start to read the back. There's this man that led these lightning tours of India. And he also, this is the book he wrote, was teaching people how to meditate in the morning light. He said it would change their life forever. And then I read at the bottom his date of birth. And it also listed his date of death, which was 3 years earlier. So years later, I had a roommate who was dying of cancer. And it was sad because she'd been an amazing success story. She'd been on the radio, in fact, talking about how she completely cleared herself of cancer, even after her body was riddled with it. But the cancer came back. And I helped her. I helped her by the series of meditations that were inspired by this man of learning to meditate in the light. We learned to visualize the light. We would have the light shining from the window on her bed, and I would get her to walk through the light to the different stages. You know, go walk through the subtle energy, walk through the planes of reality. Walk through the emotional body, the mental plane, you know, the causic plane, the causal plane, the Buddhic plane. And we took her all the way to, I would say, the fifth level. Mm-hmm. And we got to a place of just clear blue light. And she seemed very comfortable there. And I came, and then we broke it off. And I said, now, Deb, you can do this on your own. You don't need me. And she hadn't spoken to me in many months because, I mean, she had brain cancer and she had lost the ability to even speak. And I said, Deb, do you think you can do this on your own? She squeezed my hand. I said, are you comfortable? Are you comfortable that you could actually move on your own now? And she said, yes. in my eyes, like, got as big as saucers, because she hadn't spoken in months.
Wow.
And I went to the, it was a hospice center, I went to the head nurse, who was the head nun, and I said, "Deb's ready." She said, "Oh, good. She needs to go now." You know, and then she was gone. Hmm. And she visited me after she passed. And I went to the cemetery to find her body. And I heard very distinctly inside me, Deb's voice saying, "You will not find me here." Of course not.
No.
So, I mean, she had learned to actually move within the worlds. She had learned to transcend her physical body. She had learned to move in the light. She had learned the great teaching of this man from India who reached out to me. And somehow he knew that I would need this information to give to Deb. I don't know how. But that's the only way I've ever, other than writing about it, ever been able to impart his information, moving in the light.
That's a really, really beautiful story. And yeah, it's kind of crazy how the universe works, isn't it?
Yep, indeed.
Absolutely. Mysterious Messages from Beyond, Von Brashler has been our guest. He's the author of that book. It's available on the Red Feather imprint on Schiffer Publishing. We have a link in the description of this program. Click on it. Get the book. Some of those meditation techniques that we were talking about, plus many other meditation techniques, are available in the book for you to peruse and use yourself and reach out to get those messages from beyond. And just some very, very heartwarming stories as well. There's some scary stories in there as well. There's stories that will also pique your interest. And there's that story in there that is absolute nightmare fuel for me in there as well. Von, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tim. I've enjoyed it.
Folks, I want to bid you a very good weekend. Hopefully it's good weather where you are. You can get out and enjoy it. Squeeze your loved ones a little tighter this weekend. Say a few extra prayers this weekend. The world could use it. And again, take care of yourself and each other. And we will see you next week here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.